And welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. It is March 20th, and my name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. Our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. You can...
Tell.
Well, yeah, you can get all your John Deere products, all your service and parts up there at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City, right between Pine Grove and Oasis Exits. Or you can get them on the phone at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da!
There you are.
And I finally sent out something through our newsletter list online. Thanks to all of you who, you know, put your email in there and want to get updates from us. Needless to say, I'm not overpowering you with updates because I think the last update I did was in like 2020. It was a long time ago, and so I need to use that a little bit more. I won't send you anything except stuff that happens on the show or things that are coming up. But I've had a lot of people ask me about having Dr. Peter Vincent Pry on again because I think we've all grown... I'll use a really nice radio word, weary of listening to the talking heads and talk about Ukraine. I mean, it's just annoying and frustrating. And it's kind of humorous because as I was thinking, gosh, oh, you know, should I prevail on him again? I just had him on. I mean, can't make the guy our personal smart guy, but he sent me an email and he was watching Lindsey Graham on the television set, who makes me want to pull my hair out. Every time I watch Lindsey Graham, I start laughing. I'm like, I bet Dr. Pry is going bananas on this. And as it turns out, I was right. It was actually happening. So for those of you who are maybe joining us for the first time, I don't know why that would be, but you can always find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Our archives are commercial free, and they are free to listen to. You can do whatever you like with them. Post them on Facebook, send them to your friends. We don't get blocked a lot. I don't really know why. We haven't risen to the hated status
yet. Yeah, we haven't got that status
which
yet.
Which is awesome. We've been around for a long time, over 10 years. So you can do whatever you like with those archives. It makes you happy. And our guest today has been on with us since back in 2017, back in the olden days. Mid-olden days, I guess I should say. And I have all those shows listed, too, so you can go back through them. He's the executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and the director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. Both of those are congressional advisory boards. He served as the chief of staff of the Congressional EMP Commission, in addition to the staffs of the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission and the House Armed Services Committee. He was also an intelligence officer with the CIA, responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy. Hence our topics. He has a PhD in history and archaeology, and another PhD in strategic studies, which is what led him to the CIA. And he has written a bunch of very interesting books. I have them listed for you on the site for today: Blackout Warfare, The Power in the Light, Blackout Wars, EMP Manhattan Project. What's my War Scare? That's a fun one. And what's that other one? Apocalypse Unknown. Must have been fun to title. You're like, what should I call my book? How about Apocalypse Unknown? If you can work the word apocalypse into your title, you are killing it. I got nothing for that? And he just looks at me with a smirk. This is radio. You can't smirk. No one could. Okay. You know.
I was getting ready to channel Lindsey Graham.
Hashtag smirk.
Where's those MiGs 29s? Those MiG 29s. We got to get them over there.
We got to get everything over there. We got to get it all going. So Dr. Pry is on his way to Florida today. He is driving along. So we will highlight songs regarding driving. So if you're thinking they have to do with the war, they don't. We're gonna take a little detour down the avenue of driving songs, and there's so many good ones. I'm really excited about it. To punctuate our discussion about Lindsey Graham and the stupid things we're doing. So Dr. Pry, I don't know if you want to start with him or end with him or just weave him in through the entire dialogue.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me to save me from having to listen to bad music all the way down to Florida.
Yeah, that would just be, that's wrong.
But I just can't resist. And before we start talking about the idiocy of Lindsey Graham, and how Russia may destroy us in a nuclear war or by EMP and cyber attack. I'd like to talk a little bit about something I just heard on National Public Radio coming down.
Oh, this will be good. You know,
that was scintillating.
I couldn't tear my ears away from it, listening with just fascination, because yeah. We are doing such a good job destroying ourselves.
Yeah.
That Russia will not have to attack us.
Oh, is that what NPR is saying?
Yes, so I'd just like to talk about what I just heard on NPR. It may be of interest to your listeners, too, because I'm sure they're going to, this is one of the things that your children are probably going to be hearing at school. And it is that the American Revolution, all right, was not just about political freedom, but it was a consequence of the revolution. The men and women of America started rethinking gender identity, and that was part of the American Revolution. And they are serious about this and tried to make the case. They had a young graduate student on who's written a book, his doctorate thesis that got turned into a book, about a young woman who was born, I didn't catch the name, but she was born in 1780 in Rhode Island. And I guess as a teenager, she decided that she was Jesus Christ, and told the community that, and said that she was a asexual, that she was both a man and a woman, and there were people who believed her, including some wealthy people, and so she started a cult entailed men and women having the identical hairstyles, wearing the hair long, and wearing robes that would, you know, conceal their sexual identity, sort of, I guess, in the way people in Jesus' time did.
Sure.
And the members of the cult were pledged not to behave as men and women, or at least not to engage in sexual relations. They were celibate. And she called herself the Public Universal Friend, or PUF, for PUF. According to NPR and the young graduate student, this is all true. I don't know if it's true. Probably is. You know, you can find all kinds of bizarre things that happened in the early 19th century and the late 18th century in America. But I'd like to put this in context later on as sort of a rebuttal. This cult moved to... the PUF cult moved to Philadelphia, which at the time was one of the largest cities in the United States, and still is. But because it was Quaker, the Quakers had long experience with political, religious persecution themselves, and so it was one of the most tolerant cities in America, kind of akin to San Francisco of the modern era. But even the Quakers had little tolerance for blasphemy, and so they were driven out and took refuge in what was then the American frontier, and established a colony in the Great Lakes region of New York State, central New York State. I grew up in upstate New York, and I'm part of our teaching when I was a kid is we learned about some of the cults that existed in upstate New York in the early 19th century. And they didn't mention this to put it in the context of the history, but, you know, most people think of the early 19th century America and the period of the Revolution as being, and it was very agrarian. I mean, with traditional values, you know, 90% of the people were farmers. But what's not widely appreciated is that, you know, this was the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution in America. And it was a time of revolutionary change, not just in terms of the economy, but it also had the kinds of societal consequences. Because before this, you know, most people had to put all their time and energy into surviving, you know, as farmers, just earning a living out of the land, you know, with their strength and their brains, and they had little leisure time to get engaged in cults and pursue societal oddities, you know. But that started changing with the early Industrial Revolution, and particularly in New York State, because the Governor DeWitt Clinton in the early 19th century put in the canal, which you might, the Erie Canal, which connected, you could go from New York City all the way to the Great Lakes and get to the Midwest and start settling in the Midwest and all points in between. So that was such a revolutionary new technology, the canal, and the way it gave mobility to people, that for the first time it enabled, you know, the movement westward, with all the disruptive implications that implied, you know, for uprooting people who had lived their lives in it, and not just in America, but across the world, you know, canals, and then later on railroads came in. And people, the reason I'm saying this is because the NPR interpretation of the PUF movement is that because this young woman had a charismatic personality, oh, isn't this transgender person so impressive? You know, that's the impression they're trying to give. To see these some of these wealthy people followed her, and they actually bought up 14,000 acres on the frontier so they could have their colony away from the rest of society because they were not being tolerated. But that wasn't an unusual thing. You can find all kinds of examples of crazy and not so crazy utopian movements going on at the time. The Oneida community, for example, which was very close. It was just 10 miles away from where I grew up in Marston, New York. But they believed in, that it took a village to raise a child. They believed in free love. They thought that marriage was oppressive to women. Therefore, women should be able to have sexual freedom. Actually, this Oneida thing was driven by men. And the idea was that men could have any sexual partner they wanted. And that, it was really sort of, I've always thought it was an effort to live the playboy lifestyle under the guise of feminism, you know, saying this is good and liberating for women. But basically, the men didn't have to take responsibility for children. The children were raised by the village. And the women had to cooperate and have sex with any guy that wanted to have sex with them. But that's one example of
the ultimate cult.
Yeah, one of these utopian movements that died out. I think people, the Mormons originated from there, you know. They have a ceremony every year up near the edge of the Great Lakes, celebrating the discovery of the tablets that are the foundation of the Mormon religion that were left by Moroni and are supposedly the basis of Christ coming to North America, and that there allegedly had been a great civilization in North America, you know. Another one of these, and I witnessed this, an example. This one wasn't a utopian movement, but I think it underscores the naivete of the time, that some farmer, the early science, it was just beginning of paleontology at this time, and the discovery of dinosaurs and, you know, dinosaur fossils and things like that. So some farmer in upstate New York made a concrete giant that he claimed that was laying in the ground, not standing up. But he claimed he had discovered it when he was plowing fields, and he would pay people. People had to pay to see the so-called Cardiff Giant, because it was discovered near Cardiff, New York. It was later moved to the Cooperstown Museum. It's not far from the Baseball Museum in Cooperstown, New York. And every year they would bring elementary school kids, including myself, you know, I saw the Cardiff Giant, and I remember, even as a child, you know, in elementary school, saying, how could anyone possibly believe, you know, that thing was real? I mean, you know.
So you were one of you were one of those children. Who's that realist? Get him out. He's wrecking he's ruining our shtick. Dr. Pry, we have to take a really quick break, but I did discover in my quick research here in my computer that the book about the Puff cult actually was made into a musical, and we saw it as children, actually, and I found the theme song for it, so they don't have to make it into a musical now. It's already been done. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us, and here's the Puff cult piece.
Fruitcake with no nuts, so good you could go.
You're going to have all those things when you get home.
No, now. I want a ball. I want a party. Pink macaroons and a million balloons and performing baboons and give it to me. Now. I want the world. I want the whole world. I want to lock it all up in my pocket. It's my bar of chocolate. Give it to me now. I want today. I want tomorrow. I want to wear 'em like braids in my hair, and I don't want to share 'em.
The old Griswold family.
Since you're in the family truckster, I thought you decided or that you needed a theme song. But well, you were talking about that cult. All I could think of was Willy Wonka. Terrible.
Right. Carrying on with this theme about the kinds of cults and wild ideas that existed at the time. Another theory at the time is this is when the Hollow Earth theory became extremely popular early 19th century, and the idea was that the Earth was hollow, and that there were, and you could go into the inside of the Earth if you could get to the North or South Poles, which was one of the things that created an interest in Arctic and Antarctic exploration. This Hollow Earth theory, and there supposedly was another civilization living inside the Earth. Another spiritualism was a major subculture of spiritualism. The Knockers was born in upstate New York, at about the same time, where a couple of sisters, young girls, learned they could be, they could dislocate, it was either their toes or their fingers, I can't remember which it was, maybe it was both, and make noises thereby, so that they could fool adults into thinking that there was a kind of a Morse code, one crack for yes and two for no, or I don't know exactly which, but people could communicate with their departed by them, and they became a huge rage, and people really believed it. And it wasn't all bad. I mean, it was some of the early women's movement. The modern feminism was born in upstate New York. At the time, of course, people thought they were cranks and nuts. But it turned out to be something productive, as did the abolitionist movement. When people think of the American Civil War, this idea that everybody in the North was an abolitionist is not true. It was really just a small percentage of Americans were, and it began as a tiny movement in Utica, New York. I live 10 miles from Utica, and Utica was very a big birthplace, and Utica happened to be right on the Erie Canal. So, upstate New York, we think of San Francisco today as the locus of all kinds of craziness, most of it just nonsense, but some of it might actually have promise in terms of the future. And the same thing was true if you go to the early 19th century. You might think of, you know, upstate New York and the area around the canal, you know, which was the equivalent to the Silicon Valley of its day, you know, the high-tech, it was the high-tech industry of the day. You know, that was sort of the San Francisco, Northern California of the early days. So it's not surprising that, that they don't mention any of that at NPR. To put it in context, that the puff thing was just part of a lot of craziness that was going on. And why did this craziness happen? I mean, you didn't see this kind of you didn't see this kind of thing. It's true, you know, like for centuries prior, and that's because of the. This is one of the consequences, for good or ill, of the Industrial Revolution, where people got more leisure time, and they're and they weren't completely focused on survival. But beyond that, there's also something else, a negative aspect of the Industrial Revolution, or some people might. You might consider it so. There's a book worth reading is Eric Erickson's The World We Have Lost that talks about, because we often make the mistake of thinking that the people in the past, the people in the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries thought like we did, you know, and that they that their psychological profile was the same as us. But I don't think that was true. You have to remember that throughout most of human history, until the Industrial Revolution, you know, most people were farmers, and they lived in a village, you know, and they didn't travel from, say, generation after generation would live in the same village. And part of surviving was your word. You know, you couldn't lie, betray your neighbors, and expect to be kept in the village, not expelled from the village. Part of surviving was being honest and being true to your word. The old phrase, a man's word is his bond, you know, comes from a much earlier time, you know, in our history. And so people were ready to believe much more than they would today. Part of the modern Industrial Revolution and it's gotten worse over time as we have become more and more a technological society is the lies that we're surrounded with, you know, and people have become, our shields are up. Even I, as like an 8-year-old, was skeptical enough to understand that the Cardiff Giant was a fake. Even, you know, and was so disappointed and couldn't believe. How could people believe that, that thing was real? Well, that's why, you know, because people were much more ready. Maybe they were naive, but I think it was, and we kind of dismissed their gullibility and despised them for it. But maybe they don't deserve to be despised for being trusting, for taking a man at his word or a woman at her word. And those people were, call it, there was a moral stature that they had that they would not lie themselves, you know, because their lives might depend upon it in terms of village life. And so it was hard for them to imagine a bald-faced liar, you know. How society has changed.
It's a good thing time travel isn't real. Those people would all be in deep trouble.
Right. And so, anyway, so we can get on to Lindsey Graham and more serious business.
I think that's the
real lesson of the puff movement. You know, it's just a lie that the American Revolution, that men and women, as they said on NPR, the part of the American Revolution was men and women, you know, re-examining their gender identity. Maybe it was true for this tiny little cult. All right, but that was not a large, widespread consequence of the American Revolution. I think as far as you could go is that, you know, that some men and women, you know, clearly we see this with John Adams and his wife, you know, were thinking of rethinking the legal stature of women, you know, should the law be fair to women and that sort of thing, as they, as as they reexamined the issue, question of slavery, too, which was the, the founders were keenly aware, including Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, that the principles of the Declaration of Independence were contradicted by slavery, and that that had to be resolved someday, but they weren't able to do everything at once. But this notion that now they're trying to make gender identity part of the American Revolution, coming soon to an elementary school near you,
I think that's
so you heard it here first. Okay.
Yeah. Started in Valley Forge.
Right. Where this this is a kind of an intellectual early warning radar here about an incoming warhead, that is going to explode among our educational establishments to further corrupt our youth and make it unnecessary in the long run for Russia or China or North Korea to nuke us, because we're doing such a great job destroying ourselves.
Dr. Pryde, don't most of these cult movements eventually collapse under the weight of their own corruption? I mean, if you look at
talks about that.
Jim
we're just going to talk about how great they are.
And the Bhagwan up in Oregon. I mean, there's they attract thousands and thousands of people, but eventually their own corruption kind of brings them down, doesn't it?
Yes. Their own, I'd say their dysfunction brings them down. The fact that they are not necessarily corrupt, but they're not an accurate reflection of reality. Just like, communism and socialism do not accurately reflect their assumptions about human nature and about the good society are false. You end up encountering reality, and reality destroys them. And that happens, these socialist and communist states can exist only because they have the armed forces and police forces at their command, and so they can impose their will on a enslaved population. Even they eventually, like the Soviet Union, collapsed of its own weight, because the philosophical foundations were false.
Right.
And you just can't get away from that forever. And with these utopian movements that all of them we're talking about, rarely last more than a generation or two. And most of them don't attract thousands. They might attract a few dozen, maybe a couple of hundred. But they get writ large in some history books, because they're just so unusual. There actually is still a museum to pop. In the Great Lakes, almost all of these, and that happened to the pop too, by the way. Although the spin NPR puts on it is different.
Right.
NPR likes to see it as a far-sighted, pioneering effort at trans justice, but guess who destroyed it?
Well,
the white men. White men who belong to the PUF movement destroyed it. Because these are the guys, the couple of wealthy individuals who naively believed that this woman was Christ or something. They're the ones up the land. That was the basis for the colony and it enabled it to 14,000 acres in the Great Lakes. Well, I guess it was by 1819, they had lost faith. They didn't see any miracles happening. They saw this thing as there were no children produced. Some of the men wanted to have families. The idea that you could. For the men, and probably not for women either. But at least the spin that is put on it by the book and by NPR is that those hetero men who betrayed the movement, is the way they put it, became traitors to the movement and challenged. At first, they tried to accuse the leader, the PUF leader, the Public Universal Friend, who of fraud, you know, by claiming to be Christ when she wasn't, or to be a religious figure when she wasn't. But the courts, of course, had no jurisdiction over that. But they ended up destroying the movement over the property rights. Who owned the property, this colony? And because they wanted out. And they basically took their land and left. And so, yeah, the short answer to your question is, in almost all cases, these things collapse of their own weight because they're disconnected from reality. They're based on false understandings of how human society works, false understandings of human nature, and rarely last a generation or two.
And this right.
Case, you know, it was the same generation that founded the movement. You know, when they got older, it destroyed itself because it was all based on lies.
Right. Well, also, I mean, just recently, didn't the founders of Black Lives Matter get indicted for embezzling money? I mean, they had a huge thing going there.
There's another altruistic movement.
Yeah, and it turned out that, you know, they were pretty good at spending the money, but it was spending it on themselves. So
that's right. And I can see a way of transitioning, and it's not a... inaccurate, I think. We do have our own kind of utopian movement that most Americans believe, you know, naively, and that is arms control and its assumptions about nuclear weapons and nuclear strategy and a representative of this gullible, naive point of view is Lindsey Graham himself, you know, because the premise of arms control is that nuclear weapons are evil, and that is universally understood by everybody, even the Russians and the Chinese and the North Koreans and the Iranians, who, for some reason, you know, are always racing for advantages over the United States in nuclear weapons, and always writing about how you can win a nuclear war and defeat the United States in a nuclear war, and certainly act like they believe it, by digging deep underground shelters to survive a nuclear war, developing first strike strategies, and all the rest. But all that evidence doesn't impress. It's accepted as an article of faith, quite literally, in the arms control community. And you'll have people who are supposed to be sophisticated thinkers who are in the arms control community arguing that, oh, no, you know, they don't mean what they say, ignore, you know, the new generations of missiles and warheads that the bad guys are building. They can't believe that you can fight and win a nuclear war. That's just not rational. You know, it doesn't fit into any of our rational actor models. And that's what Lindsey Graham, in effect, said. He said, you know, ignore Putin, his threats about a nuclear war, ignore his putting his nuclear forces...
Uh-oh. He's gone through a minor dead zone there on the highway.
You know, which is a cockpit for fighting a nuclear war. That would mean that that he can launch most of his nuclear forces in minutes from one of these underground shelters. And he's the National Command Authority. So, you know, when he has the capabilities to do it, I would say a responsible, prudent person would take him at his word and be very worried about that. But not Lindsey Graham. You know, Lindsey Graham on TV, when I wrote you that note, was it Friday? I can't remember the day.
No, it was Thursday. It was the 17th.
Last week he said, oh, Putin's just bluffing. It's just saber rattling. Ignore his nuclear threats. We can jump in to Ukraine and do as much as we want militarily. He's not going to act on that threat because the use of nuclear weapons would be the end of the world. And Putin's own generals will stop him from using nuclear weapons. Now, that is an incredibly naive and optimistic hope that we should trust Lindsey Graham's judgment when it comes to the nuclear threat from Russia, and that there basically is no nuclear threat from Russia, which is what Lindsey Graham is saying, and therefore we can charge into Ukraine and rescue the Ukrainians without fear of America getting nuked, or our own forces, or the Ukrainians getting hit with tactical nuclear weapons. And then in an inconsistent, contradictory way, he then said that if they did use tactical nuclear weapons, because the fallout from the tactical nuclear weapons would affect NATO countries, it would then become an Article 5 that would justify the United States, you know, jumping in even at the nuclear level. You know, and he's wrong about that because obviously the man doesn't understand that Russia has these new generation tactical and strategic nuclear weapons that we've talked about on your show that are almost pure fusion. Even the older style tactical nuclear weapons can be used in a way that produces no fallout. But the new generation ones can be, you know, very low yield, you know, for very selective targeting. So they're just like powerful battlefield nuclear weapons.
But some, we're going to take a really quick break here. But when we come back, let's stick with that, because honestly, I do think that there's a concerted effort to, you know, tell people that there's really nothing to see here and they should move along.
Well, also, Putin's generals are dwindling away because they just knocked off another one. So he's going to have a whole new batch of them here pretty quick.
They're channeling all them and they know what's going on.
Yeah.
So you're listening to We the People. And our guest today is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He is on the road on his way to Florida. He is he's graciously agreed to spend some time with us and decode what we keep hearing in the... We'll just leave that space blank for you to fill in whatever media. And you can find this program after the fact at wethepeopleradio.us.
I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel. I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile. My curiosity running wild. Cruising and playing the radio. With no particular place to go. Riding along in my automobile.
Yeah, like that. Yeah. Every road trip I've been on, that's what it was like.
Yeah.
Okay, so Dr. Pry, Lindsey Graham's, I guess I've always assumed that he was sort of saying, well, if they push the button, it'll destroy the whole world, so they're not going to do it. Is that what he's trying to assure us won't happen? Or is he saying, oh, no, the nukes are so little, like it won't even affect us over here. It'll just be an over-there thing, so don't worry about that either.
Oh, he's saying the former.
Okay.
And by the way, anybody who is listening to We the People Radio in his automobile is not alone. So... But yeah, he's saying the former. I mean, this is part of the religious faith that undergirds arms control. You know, the belief that the nuclear weapons themselves are evil. Okay, and a greater threat than the ideology of our enemies. And that's why it's worth it for the United States to always try to lead the way on arms control, even if it means disarming unilaterally, hoping that they will follow our good example, because they too must view the world the same way we do. They must understand. Only a crazy person wouldn't understand that nuclear weapons are not usable, that you can't win a nuclear war, that it would be the end of the world if you were to use nuclear weapons. And therefore, Lindsey Graham is arguing, you know, and it's an argument that's premised on these arms control assumptions that are prevalent, you know, in our defense community and our strategic community, but particularly in our political community. You know, we do have some sane people in the Pentagon, especially in strategic command, but theirs is a minority voice, you know, compared to the people who actually make policy, the politicians, the universities that are so respected, and the But yeah, that we don't have to worry about the Russians nuking us, so we can jump into Ukraine. There's only a madman would think about using, could use nuclear weapons. And it's such an insane thing to do that we can have high confidence in Lindsey Graham's judgment that the Russian generals themselves would stop Putin from using nuclear weapons.
Right.
So no problem, no sweat. Let's get in there and hammer the Russians along with the Ukrainians and cover ourselves with glory. I mean, that's in effect what he's arguing. And it's not just him, but if any, I'm sure your listeners who watch TV every night, the mainstream, including Fox News, I mean, that's with a few exceptions like Tucker Carlson, that seems to be what even the Fox News commentators, want to do, support the Ukrainians at all costs. Zelensky is the new Churchill. It's a shame on us to not go in there and save Ukrainian democracy, put quotes around that. The only thing holding us back is the fear of a nuclear war, of getting into a World War III. Even Joe Biden, to his credit, has said that, and I'm sure he's been told to say that, but obviously the woke advisors that surround him, even the woke advisors who surround him, aren't as far gone as Lindsey Graham is. My fear, though, is that, because these guys are also, it's the most anti-nuclear administration in American history. Biden has brought into his administration and in the Congress people who are opinion leaders and in power positions, like Adam Smith, who's the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, share these arms control views, these minimum deterrence anti-nuclear views. Nuclear weapons are not usable. You can't fight to win a nuclear war. That's crazy. Therefore, we can safely dismantle U.S. nuclear arsenal and downsize it to just a few hundred weapons on maybe six submarines, which is what Adam Smith has been advocating, and having a minimum deterrence posture, so that would be very deeply cutting. Currently we have, under New START, we're allowed 1,550 warheads, and, if the most extreme, if the Adam Smith position, is taken, and he's not alone. I mean, there are people in the Biden administration who support this too. It would bring it down from 1,500 nuclear weapons to 300 nuclear weapons. And they think deterrence would continue to work just fine under those circumstances. That's what they were planning to do or pushing for before the Ukrainian war broke out and Russia's nuclear threat. Also, the buildup of China's nuclear arsenal and the rapidly expanding threat from North Korea, all of that has made it a real political hard sell for the anti-nuclear woke people in the Biden administration. And that may be the only reason it doesn't happen in the nuclear posture review or under Joe Biden. Although, don't put it past them yet. I mean, they are clearly, they're an example. The whole Biden administration is an example of a cult that does not recognize reality, doesn't live in the real world, but lives in a fantasy world, where they think climate change is a bigger threat than Russia and China and North Korea.
Yeah.
And they think that, therefore, we all have to pay, and I'm seeing these huge, these high gas prices, believe me, as I head to Florida, and that it'll be worth it to have to pay even more money. Biden is trying to dress it up as getting back at the Russians by us paying at the pump. But that's really just a cover for what they always wanted to do, which is to make gas prices go through the roof to save the planet, to get us off of so-called fossil fuels. And therefore, we're going to cut off our own nose by not accepting Russian oil and not trying to replace the Russian oil by opening up our own pipeline and engaging in expanded, energy production of oil and natural gas here at home. Another example of a fantasy world, how these fantasies have real-world impact because they run into reality. They run into the reality of the fact that we are a fossil fuel, I shouldn't use that word, a carbon-based fuel economy, you know, and we can't live without it. And it's going to destroy us if we try to, because the technology that they're promoting is just not advanced enough to replace it. And it also empowers our enemies, like Russia, you know, that will have no problem selling it, every drop, every barrel of oil it produces, and all of its natural gas to China, which is hungry for energy. But we might not have to worry about the long-term economic consequences of the Biden administration's energy policies. If they get us into a nuclear war with Russia, that will solve all of our problems, because two of us will be left alive to see the consequences of the climate change policies, which are also, an existential threat. Not climate change of being an existential threat, but the policies that are being proposed are an existential threat to our civilization.
Well, the high fuel prices, I mean, they've been, gas prices have been off the charts in Europe and over there for years and years. And they're not all switched over to electric. In fact, I think they're getting rid of a lot of their green windmills and so forth because they see now that it doesn't work and it is costing their economy a ton of money.
Well, and it's not reliable.
Yeah, it's not reliable. And yet we don't even look at that. We just figure, well, we're gonna do the same thing. It's gonna fail just like it's failed over there, and they're gonna have to go back.
Well, you're assuming that they're logical and that facts matter.
Yeah.
But when you're dealing with a religious cult, a quasi-religious cult, facts don't matter.
Yeah.
The logic doesn't matter. That's why it's just shocking to see it confirmed, right in front of our eyes that. It's ideology, a dysfunctional, untrue ideology, is driving the administration's energy policy, and it's also driving the administration's foreign policy as regards to the Ukraine war, which we, should talk about in more detail about why that is so, and why we should not be involved in the Ukraine war, why we should not be risking a war with Russia. That's not in our interest to do so. I mean, most Americans have common sense, I think, and should be able to see that for themselves, but I don't know. I question whether most Americans do have that common sense when I see that even Fox News, beating the war drums for supporting Ukraine.
Well, the worst part is that they're playing on the heartstrings of everyone. All they do is show the same, things being blown up, and look at everyone suffering, and you have... You're living in a comfortable place. You owe them. You owe them. Basically, I think is the thing. You owe them.
Yeah.
We have to take a really.
And we will
not,
pay the bill to rebuild Ukraine.
I won't lie to you like I do to my dogs when we're going to be back in 5 seconds. We're not taking a really quick break. We're taking a short break. We have to have some news. We'll see what they have for us today. Our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and he's driving along on his way to Florida. So you can speed now because it's the break. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
afternoon, and welcome to the second half of We the People Radio on March 20th, 2022. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape has everything to do with John Deere. If you need tractors or mowers or attachments, need your tractor worked on or just need to buy some parts for it, go up and see them. They've got a great inventory. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Or you can give them a call. Our phone number is 226-9226, or catch them on the web at Pape Machinery. That's spelled P-A-P-E, machinery.com. There you have it.
Ta-da!
Yeah.
So, we are chatting with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry about, the Ukraine thing. And this will be the version that you don't get through the mainstream media because they're... they seem to only have one message these days. There's not a lot of variety.
War.
Yeah. We better get over there and do it because otherwise we're not nice.
It's our duty.
Hey, Dr. Pry, before we get back to the nuclear part of it, which is super important, but we were talking during the break, and Bill's first comment when we paused there was, yep, and no matter what happens, we're going to wind up having to go rebuild it because we got in too late and now we owe them. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that will probably be the administration's position if they stay in power. If the Russians don't take Ukraine over, that's the one scenario where we won't have to go and rebuild it.
That'll save us some money.
and I still think it's the most likely scenario for reasons I'll explain later. But I'm disappointed in myself that I've let half the show go by, and I still haven't told you the most important thing I wanted to tell your audience.
Oh.
And that is, you know, the message of the article I wrote, you know, which is the nuclear 9/11 in our future, that right now, I think, you know, that we're facing the greatest nuclear crisis, a more serious nuclear crisis than the Cuban Missile Crisis. And this is more dangerous than the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, precisely because Washington doesn't believe has this ideology of arms control that dominates their worldview and their threat perception. They find it so hard to understand the adversary military doctrine, the adversary worldview, that yes, you can fight and win a nuclear war, and we're prepared to do it. They just can't bring themselves to believe that. We've been so trained in our side, in the West, to think that nuclear war is unthinkable, that they will come up with and so indoctrinated to fear it as the apocalypse, that they will engage in denial behavior to deny evidence, plain evidence, right in front of their faces about the elevated nuclear threat. It's not just Lindsey Graham is an idiot. He's just one of the foremost and most vociferous examples. But official Washington, the people who are supposed to be smart, right, on these issues, are also so biased and blind that they will not be able to provide warning to our political and military leaders, not even warning, you know, when a surprise attack may occur or actually does occur. And I say that because of what happened on March 8th, where America's top intelligence officer, a top spy, a lady named Avril Haines, right, testified to Congress, basically, don't worry about all those nuclear threats from Putin. He's saber-rattling, he's bluffing. She admits that it's extraordinary what he has said and his allegation that he put his forces on high alert, but she claims that we don't have to worry because the intelligence community has been watching Russia's strategic forces like a hawk, and they don't see any evidence of the ballistic missile submarines putting to sea, or the bombers being mobilized, or the mobile ICBMs going to field. And therefore, you know, all these indicators suggest that Russia's strategic forces are not more ready than normal to make a nuclear attack. They're not mobilized to mobilizing to make a nuclear attack. So Putin is just bluffing. And all of that is either a lie, or we're even worse off than if they're lying. Our intelligence community has become so incompetent that they have forgotten, you know, how Russia is prepared for a nuclear war and surprise nuclear attack. And if I could just go through some of these technical issues.
Yeah, please.
You know, when I worked for the CIA, one of my jobs was I was a senior analyst with the National Intelligence Officer for Strategic Warning. And I worked on paradigms for warning about a nuclear war. When it might happen, what do we look for, what can't we see? And I actually got a special award, a unique award, the only time it had ever been given. When I left CIA to work for Congress, praising me for my work on these paradigms. And I guess I don't deserve that award, because it's obviously my work obviously didn't penetrate the brain of the people who are still there in the intelligence community. You know, let's go through this. Intelligence and warning indicators of nuclear war 101. All right, a basic course. One of the most fundamental things is there a major war in Europe involving the nuclear superpowers? That's one of the big indicators where you should be very concerned about an elevated threat of nuclear war. And it's actually happening. But I guess DNI Haynes doesn't count that anymore. You know, that for some reason, is not regarded as an indicator. Next, has the National Command Authority, and that is dictator Putin, I mean, he is the National Command Authority for Russia, has he declared a heightened alert of his forces? And he has. Maybe it's a lie. Strange that he would be lying, but he has declared it. You know, is there reason we should believe it? Keeping in mind, by the way, I, and in defense of the intelligence community, also testifying to Congress was the General Barrier, who is the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Now, he's not the top spy. DIA is one of, you know, a dozen of the intelligence agencies, but it's one of the biggest. And he did say, you know, when Vladimir Putin makes nuclear threats, we have to take him very, very seriously. Now, that's a common sense thing, you know. To assume the man is lying is extremely irresponsible, especially when you're talking about the defense and intelligence community that are charged with protecting America and the American people from a nuclear war. To just blow it off and say, oh, I don't believe him, so don't worry about it.
Yeah. That makes no sense.
Right. This is like, to put it down into more understandable human terms, suppose you had a neighbor, you know, who was an outpatient from, a mental institution with a history of a violent criminal past, and you hear this guy shooting off his guns in his backyard all the time, and he takes a dislike to you, and he threatens to shoot you, and you call the cops. And the reaction of the police is, I don't even want to talk to him. Don't worry about it. He's just bluffing. I mean, that's exactly the scenario we're in.
Yep.
You know, where Russia's got a nuclear gun pointed at us, and the people that are supposed to protect us are saying, don't worry about it. He's just bluffing. You know, now, if we go through these so-called... the reason it may be incompetent is there's a phenomenon called mirror imaging, you know, that happens when you assume that the other side has to do what you would do. In order to mobilize our forces for a nuclear war, for example, you know, we would have to send our ballistic missile submarines to sea because they have intermediate range ballistic missiles, and they have to go to sea in order to reach Russia. And we, you know, most of our weapons are on ballistic missile submarines and bombers, so we also have to mobilize our bomber force. And we have a lot of people in the intelligence community who have served in the bomber service and in the and the submarine service. And so they, too, would advise Avril Haines. They'd probably think, well, the Russians, you know, do it the way we do. But they don't. Russia has a completely different strategic culture from ours. You know, they have been subject to surprise attacks and invasions throughout their history. And this bloody history has made them cautious to the point of paranoia. We would call it paranoia. They are rational actors, but they're very differently rational than we are because they have a very different history where they have been victims of surprise attacks. Most recently, for example, is Operation Barbarossa, which was a massive surprise attack launched on them by Nazi Germany in World War II that very nearly succeeded in destroying the Soviet Union. And that and the other part of their history has conditioned them to say, we're never going to let that happen again. If there's ever another war, it's not going to be fought on our territory, and we're going to be the ones making the surprise attack. We will be the first ones to strike. That's where they're coming from. And they have postured their strategic forces to do exactly that. So they rely much more heavily on ICBMs. The ICBMs are the smallest part of our triad. They carry the fewest warheads. And our triad is not designed for surprise attack. It's basically a long arms control philosophy. It's designed for what arms controllers call strategic stability and transparency. Arms control people like the fact that we have to send our submarines to sea, because that way we can politically signal, we can use our strategic forces to signal to the Russians that we're worried about something they're doing, and so we're going to send our subs to sea as a warning. And also, when our submarines are not at sea, they can see our submarines are still at port, and so they don't have to worry about a surprise attack. Same thing with the bombers. We have to mobilize the bombers. That would be very visible. In fact, it takes 3 days for us to mobilize our bomber. And the arms control community likes that. You know, they think that's a good thing. You know, from a Russian perspective, they don't want to be in a position where they have to mobilize stuff and it's going to be seen, because it gives the adversary a chance to beat them to the draw and make the surprise attack first. So they rely very heavily on ICBMs and are MIRVed ICBMs. So their ICBMs carry more than one warhead. Like their, you know, best ICBM, the SS-18, you know, carries 10 warheads. Our ICBMs only carry one warhead because we don't want to be in a position to make a surprise attack. You know, that's destabilizing in our arms control theory. So therefore, the ICBMs, the Russian ICBMs, have command and control arrangements, and they're in a condition every day called constant combat readiness. So over 95% of them are ready to launch on 3 minutes' notice, and they have command and control arrangements for their ICBMs, so they can do this in secret. You know, what about those mobile ICBMs? Don't they have to go to the field, like Avril Haines said? No, they don't. You know, the garages for their mobile ICBMs, they have retractable roofs, so they don't have to send ICBMs to the field or increase it. They always have some in the field, but they don't have to increase the numbers. They can launch them right from the garages. And the guys in the field, there are cables out there in the field, so they can connect into those cables, so they can get secret commands to launch the ICBMs in the field. Even Russia's submarines carry intercontinental ballistic missiles. You know, unlike our submarines, which have to go to sea because they have intermediate range missiles, their submarines can strike the United States right from port. They don't have to go to sea.
What does that mean, intermediate? How close do they have to be?
Well, an intermediate range missile has a range under about 5,000 kilometers. You know, so that we would have to send our submarines out, at least to the mid-Pacific, to the mid-Atlantic, you know, to be in a position
right.
to strike Russia. They don't have to do that. They can launch their submarine missiles right from port, and they have command and control. They're wired so they can execute them, just as if they're silo-based ICBMs. Even the submarines, the Russian submarines that are at sea, don't need to get emergency action messages the way we would do it. In order to send launch orders to our submarines, you know, we would send out what are called TACAMO aircraft. They're mostly based at Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma. So they have to fly from Oklahoma out to the Atlantic, you know, roughly where the patrol area of our submarines are and out to the Pacific. And then they put down a big trailing wire, you know, to send very low-frequency signals to the submarine. It's called a bell ringer to say, we have orders from you, urgent orders. You know, you have to come close to the surface to put up an antenna to receive those orders. Anyway, it's a complicated process that takes hours to do. You know, this is not the case with the Russian submarine. Port, they got to be ordered to do it secretly with their command and control arrangements, and even their submarines at sea. Unlike our submarine, the Russians do send their ballistic missile submarines out to patrols in the Atlantic and Pacific sometimes, but most of the times they don't. Most of the times they're either in port or they're in what are called bastion areas, the White Sea or the Sea of Okhotsk. These are seas that are very close to the borders of Russia, and so the Navy can protect them. You know, they're afraid that we would try to sink their ballistic missile submarine if they were out in the deep ocean with our attack submarines as part of a surprise attack. So they protect those submarines, and they they have cables on the bottom of the ocean in the White Sea and the Sea of Okhotsk. So even the seaborne, the submarines at sea, they don't need to send air TACAMOs out, which is a very visible thing, you know, that they would, the way we would do it. You know, the submarines can connect to those undersea cables, and DNI Haynes and nobody on our side would ever know it. So basically, all of the Russian intercontinental ballistic missile force, which is all their ICBMs, all their ballistic missile submarine warheads, that's most of their weapons. The least important part of the Russian triad is their bombers.
Okay, hold that thought, Dr. Pry. I knew we had to take a break. I was trying to find a logical spot. Hold that thought. We'll be right back. We are talking with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. To the king of the road. How's the drive going, by the way?
Very well. You know, one of the reasons I like the people, it makes the time go by more quickly.
Yeah, might as well chit-chat about nuclear war while you're, you know, headed to Florida.
it's better than listening to NPR.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for that.
Also a transgender,
yeah.
Transgender revolution.
Yeah, who knows what else they may come up with today. And, that's not going to help your driving abilities. Oh, what a bunch of lunatics. Bill had a question for you, though, before we moved on.
Yeah, on your Newsmax article, you had made the comment... If they did make a first strike, our ability to make a second strike may not be there. Elaborate.
Well, that's
on
right.
That.
Sure. You know, the first thing they're going to do is hit us with an EMP. That's going to paralyze our command and control capabilities, and it could paralyze the nuclear forces themselves that are on the continental United States. Even the small number of ballistic missile submarines that we have on patrol at sea, we normally have about four, two in the Atlantic, two in the Pacific, may be rendered useless because the captains have to get unlocking codes, and it's off. need to know what target they're shooting at.
Right.
And they need to be able to unlock the weapons themselves and the missiles to launch them. And if they can't get EAM, then those submarines are basically, it's called a system kill. The submarine and the crew will still be alive, but if it can't operate, it's as good as dead as far as the war is concerned. So just with the EMP attack alone, and they have super EMP weapons. We don't. You know, they might win the war that way. But the Russians, of course, being very conservative military planners, they might not be happy to hit us with just the EMP. You know, they've got, that's why they have the SS-18, for example, which alone, just using that missile, is enough to deliver the 500 highly accurate warheads that would destroy our ICBM silos, the three bomber bases, the two ballistic missile submarine ports where most of our boats and a few of the command and control centers like Tinker Air Force Base that I mentioned and Peterson Air Force Base, you know, which is where Space Command and NORAD are located. So that they would destroy, it's called a counterforce attack. They would destroy our military forces and the command control capabilities to coordinate and execute those forces.
Sure.
And win a nuclear war that way.
Right.
I mean, you know, and it would entail, as time goes on, but right now it would entail very few casualties, which is one of the other things that makes it attractive from their perspective, you know, because if their attack did fail, you know, they're not attacking major cities, they're not inflicting, you know, mass destruction of the population, and therefore it wouldn't make sense for us, if their attack failed, to retaliate against their cities. You know, we would have tried to do counterforce attacks back at them, and we're not really as well equipped to do that. Our forces are not designed for that as well as the Russian forces are. So it's the temptation to do it could be very high, you know, because of the payoff. Back in 1975, Jim Schlesinger, who was a friend of mine, gone now, but he's the only man who was both the Secretary of Defense and the Director of the CIA. He was a brilliant, brilliant guy. But when he was Secretary of Defense, using 1975-era nuclear weapons, he did it. The Department of Defense did exchange models and calculations about what would the U.S. Deaths be, casualties be, from a nuclear war where the Russians did a first strike, a disarming first strike against our bombers and our ICBM and submarines and ports. And that's when we had many more ICBMs. We had over 1,000 ICBMs in those days. We had only got 400 today. And we had many more bomber bases. We've only got 3 bomber bases today. Back then, we had 45 bomber bases. And doing all of that, the Defense Department calculated it would inflict 2 million dead in the United States. You know, that's, you know, less than 1% of the population.
Right.
Oh, those are horrific losses, right? But it's not the end of the United States as a civilization. We would have very great incentive not to hit their cities. You know, we would try to do what we could against their forces in such an exchange, but because they struck first, that's why they've got things like mobile ICBM. You know, their silos-based missiles would already be launched, so we'd be hitting empty silos. Their bombers would have been moved out so that we would be hitting empty bomber bases. Their ballistic missile submarines would probably have participated, so the submarines would either be empty or they'd be going to sea. So the guy who goes first has got tremendous strategic advantages, and that was 1975. You know, Russian weapons, modern weapons today, you know, they're 55 years more advanced than they were in 1975. You know, they're much more accurate. They can use lower yields. They've got warheads of new design that can produce little or no fallout. So so the collateral damage they would have to inflict on the civilian population, on the non-combatants, it would probably be much less today, but it would certainly be much less today. And therefore, the incentive for them, the temptation to do it, goes way up. And that's why when idiot Lindsey Graham, you know, and not just idiot Lindsey Graham, I don't want to focus at all on him, but the bigger failure is our own intelligence community. You know, lying to the American people about the risk of a nuclear war. And I think they're covering up. I hope they're covering up. I hope they're not so ignorant, you know, that they have forgotten the basics about how the Russians can execute a surprise attack. And but I think they're covering up because they don't want, because the Biden administration doesn't want another of something far worse than Afghanistan, the Afghanistan debacle, you know.
Yeah.
Don't want to admit, look at my policies in Ukraine have brought us to the verge of a nuclear war, and now I don't know what to do. I mean, that's basically where we are.
Right.
And, you know, and that is a real politically damaging thing to have to admit. So there's an enormous, Sir Avril Haines, who is his handpicked, Biden's handpicked director of national intelligence, you know, obviously doesn't want to put her boss in an unflattering light. And that's why we're... But it's not. It's worse than that. We're not just being lied to, but to make the lie credible, they have not raised the readiness level of our strategic forces. You know, we have 5 readiness levels: DEFCON 5, which is the lowest readiness level, to DEFCON 1, which is the highest readiness level. And in the past, whenever the Russians, when we have known them, when they've been making overt nuclear threats and doing things that make that threat credible, in the past, what we have done is raise the level of our forces, raise the DEFCON level, to posture our forces in a more survivable way so they're not so vulnerable to a first strike, to a surprise attack. That's what Kennedy did, for example, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He went all the way up to DEFCON 2, which is just short of a nuclear war. And it worked. You know, it got Khrushchev to back off and take the missiles out of Cuba. And you know, and resolve the confrontation peacefully. It helped that we had a 5-to-1 superiority in ICBMs back then. But to leave our forces unmobilized and at DEFCON 5, I mean, you know, it's inviting a nuclear Pearl Harbor, or what I, as I term it in the article, a nuclear 9/11, and could add another spectacular intelligence failure to the long list of intelligence failures that our intelligence community committed to over the course of its history, and in recent days, as recently as Afghanistan, in terms of getting things wrong. So, you know, the American people are either being lied to, or the intelligence community is so incompetent that they don't recognize the threat. I think it's the former. I think we're being lied to, and that we're really in the middle of something that's graver than the Cuban Missile Crisis. And why is that? Why is it worse than the Cuban Missile Crisis? Because we haven't increased the DEFCON level. You know, the other side is almost certainly ready for a surprise attack if things go so badly that they feel that they need to do that. And we are exposed to that. We are postured so that a surprise attack would succeed and be rewarded if they were to do it. Thanks, because Joe Biden doesn't want to admit that he's got us into a situation that's far worse than his Afghanistan debacle. And it's all being done for political reasons, you know. They want to win the midterms.
Right.
They don't want another political embarrassment. American national security be damned. You know, that's where we are. It's even worse than what I've been telling you. You know, I didn't even put this into the article. But maybe I should have. But these calls to assassinate Putin that are going on.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about
from
that.
Republicans.
Yeah.
These people, they have, you know, and it shows the ignorance of our political leadership class. They're so, and of our intelligence community, too. The Biden administration should have put a stop to those kinds of, that kind of talk. You know, because the Russians have got a system called dead hand. That's what we call it. It's actually called perimeter. You know, this is a doomsday machine, so that if the National Command Authority is killed, they can switch, they switch this thing on in advance, and maybe they have. We don't know whether they've done it or not. This might be the special nuclear alert that Putin was talking about, or part of it. You switch on the dead hand, and if the political leadership is killed, it will automatically launch a retaliatory strike. In this case, it would be a first strike because we're not making a nuclear attack.
Sure.
But it would strike all of Russia's enemies. It would make nuclear attacks to you know, a plague upon everybody's house, and destroy everybody.
Gosh, yeah, they haven't mentioned that. They've specifically neglected to bring that up.
Yeah, a little oversight there about what could happen if you assassinate Putin. You know, that's what you could happen. Bring on the very nuclear war that Lindsey Graham claims will never happen.
Do you think by raising do you think by raising the DEFCON level would alert them and cause them to react?
It could. I'm not saying that's without risk, but judging who we're dealing with. You know, Putin, and I don't want people to get the false impression. You know, Tucker Carlson, for example, is always getting criticized as being, a Russian agent a fan of Putin.
I'm sure we are now, too.
Those of us who are criticizing the administration's policies and are saying it is not worth the risk getting us involved in the war of Ukraine, it is that we have no vital strategic interest in Ukraine. It is not worth risking the American people for Ukraine. We are not Russian sympathizers. We are not on the side of Putin. I think Putin is evil. I think he's a dictator. He's a killer, former KGB thug. And for that very reason, there is no really safe thing to do. But judging historically, you know, what we've done in the past, I think the most dangerous thing is to leave yourself vulnerable to a killer.
Appealing to them with humanitarian, the humanitarian appeal is just stupid. We have to take a really quick break, but did want to draw people's attention to the website today on March 20th, 2022, at We the People. We have the article, and it's Dr. Price's exact message was it's a shorter version of the article that will be published in Newsmax behind a paywall on Monday as Biden blunders toward nuclear war. He's added some analysis recommendations and I'm providing an advanced copy with extra information, and that is on our website. You can just click on it. There's also a downloadable Word file with that on there, so I would encourage you to go read that. The spoiler alert, it explains all the DEFCON stuff and all that. So for people that are kind of going, I don't even know what this is all about. Is this scary or bad or what are we talking? Yeah, go read about it. It's interesting, and please send it to a friend. We will be right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I tell you what I'd do. I'd go downtown, buy a Mercury or two. I'm crazy about a Mercury. Lord, I'm crazy about a Mercury. I'm gonna buy me a Mercury and cruise it up and down the road. I'm gonna buy me a Mercury and cruise it up and down the road. Yeah, I'm gonna buy me a Mercury and cruise it up and down the road.
We return to the highway with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry.
We have so little time left, and I'm afraid I've wasted so much of your time because there was so much more I wanted to say. Let me just try to compress it.
It's okay. There's always another week.
Okay. First I wanted to finish answering Bill's question about if we mobilize our forces now, you know, could that result in the Russians deciding to strike us? And it is a risk, yeah. That is a risk. It should have been done immediately when the Russians started announced the mobilization of their forces. We should have done the same when they were doing it. Now that they're mobilized, we don't know to what level, but we know that their ICBMs are always ready to go. So, yeah, it's risky to do it, but in my judgment, it's even riskier to leave our forces unmobilized at DEFCON 5 you know, because we don't know what's going to happen in Ukraine. They might decide, okay, the stupid Americans have exposed their neck to us. Let's take advantage of it, especially with all this talk about destroying Russia, fomenting a revolution in Russia to topple their elite, assassinating Putin and all of that. I'm no fan of the Russian regime, but I am a fan of America and the American people, and I don't want us getting killed by such imprudent, you know, the threats and fantasies, too. You know, about, for example, that was one of Lindsey Graham's ideas. Well, Lindsey, they don't have a Second Amendment in Russia. You know, you would be sending thousands of Russians to their deaths against the armed MVD and army that would defend that regime. Or if we succeeded in fomenting a revolution in Russia, they would probably launch a nuclear strike to take us down, too. The short answer is, we've got to, I don't think we should ever leave ourselves vulnerable to a surprise attack. We need to move our forces to a more survivable posture, but we should also communicate that to Putin, you know, through our embassy and say, look, you have put your forces on a higher alert. You leave us no little alternative but to do the same. Please bring your forces down so we can bring our forces down. And in fact, we could even use that as a basis for trying to negotiate an end to all the killing and say, you know, look at, you know, this issue for both of our countries, you know, is raise the risk of a nuclear war. What is it going to take, you know, to end this thing? And it could give us a basis for going back to negotiating the peace treaty that the Russians originally offered, that we had talked about on your previous show. And it wasn't the demands they had in that peace treaty were not unreasonable. A lot of the terms were even more in our interest than they were in the Russian interest. Another point I want to make, because a lot of people are going to say, just like Lindsey Graham, well, look at, why can't we, shouldn't we cover ourselves with glory? The Ukrainians are winning the war. And, you know, let's go teach Russia a lesson and beat up on the Russians and destroy the Russian army in Ukraine. We don't know what's happening in Ukraine. Everything we're hearing is coming from the Ukrainian government, which has got an interest in trying to exaggerate their victories, you know, if they have actually had the victory. Many lies they've told. And also from the Biden administration, which has a political interest in trying to make it look like the Russian invasion has backfired and is stalled and is not going to succeed, because they want to distract attention from the fact that Biden sacrificed America's credibility, you know, when he drew a line in the sand over Ukraine and Russian tanks rolled right over it. You know, they would rather have the conversation about how bad the Russians are doing. It may be true. That the Russians are doing badly in Ukraine. I'm just saying that we don't know. The fog of war is too thick. Look at what we were told by our own intelligence people and our own army about how well things were supposed to be going in Afghanistan, right?
Yeah.
And we had our own army involved and our own intelligence people. We weren't having to believe the Ukrainians or an independent source or a politically biased administration. So we're not going to really know until after the Ukraine war is over. And it may be long after it's over what the real truth is about what happened on the ground and what's happening on the ground. And I'm going to offer a scenario here in the last, you know, I know we're almost out of time here. But
okay, we have like 10 minutes.
This is just for something for you to think about. Just for something to think about. And I'm not saying that this is the situation. I'm saying we don't know what the situation is. But, you know, the Russians are great. The Russian general staff, they're great students of military history. Unlike our West Point and Annapolis, unfortunately, where we don't study military history as much as we should. I keep thinking about the Battle of Austerlitz. One of the 21 decisive battles of the world. It was Napoleon's greatest victory. It was a victory over the Russians, the combined force of the Russians, the Austrians, and the Prussians. It gave Napoleon control of Europe for a decade after his victory. And he achieved this victory by a great deception. He deliberately took the part of the battlefield that was least advantageous to him geographically. And he convinced his adversaries that the French army was on the ropes, that its morale was very low, that it was on the verge of disintegration. He had regiments run away, an apparent cowardice from the Russians. And all of this was designed to lure the Russians and the Austrians into attacking. You know, he had built up secretly a big reserve of forces that then crushed them. They came down and tried to attack. Is it possible? I'm not saying that this is so, but, you know, because the fog of war covers the battlefield. But we should at least entertain the possibility that if we did jump into the Ukraine war, that all of the intelligence we're being given about how badly the Russians are doing turns out to be wrong. You know, maybe they're playing a battle of Austerlitz strategy here. Is it possible they want us to intervene in Ukraine so they could then use their vast superiority in tactical nuclear weapons to solve the NATO problem forever? Just a thought.
Yeah. No, it's very, you know, I've always thought it's odd to me that a country like Russia, with an army the size that it has, goes into Ukraine and stumbles and can't get a real good footing and is being held off by a totally inferior.
Yes, and how it's lasted this long?
Well, they're up against an inferior opponent, and I had a hard time believing that they were that ill prepared when they went in. I mean, it didn't look right to me either. So I don't know. You might be onto something there.
Yeah. To argue the other side of the question, but from a different angle, let's suppose the Russians are doing as badly as the mainstream media is saying. Does that mean that NATO is going to do better? Okay, and be able to defeat the Russians?
Right.
Let's not forget that the Ukrainian army was trained by the Russians. They used Russian tactics and strategy. All of their equipment is Russian equipment. Ukraine started the war anyway with 1,500 main battle tanks. You know, that's more main battle tanks than Germany, the United Kingdom, the Benelux countries, Germany, and Poland combined. Mm. So, you know, it wasn't like Ukraine was that much of a pushover compared to European NATO. You know, now they did have a vast inferiority when it came to the Air Force. This too would argue for great caution. You know, Ukraine is not a NATO-trained, NATO-armed nation. If it is defeating the Russians, it's not because of the training they've gotten from the United States, as much as the Biden administration would like to propagandize to that effect. And it's not because they're armed with American and NATO-built equipment. You know, it's because they know how the Russians fight, and they have Russian equipment, and they've been trained by the Russians, and their general staff thinks like the Russians. And if they are doing as well, that's why. You know, so we shouldn't assume that our equipment and our NATO, European, German, and UK-trained forces, if they did go into Ukraine, would do as well as the Ukrainians. You know, but anyway, these are just some of the things I've thought about as to why, you know, we shouldn't assume that it's going to be a cakewalk if we get involved in a war with Ukraine. And don't forget that 10-to-1 superiority in tactical nuclear weapons. It's at least a 10-to-1 superiority. An analogy I would like to use to the audience, too. But I say we have no... Even if it were true that... I'll end with the analogy. Even if it were true that we had vital national interests at stake in Ukraine, I would still be against American intervention, because our most important interest would be put at risk, which is the survival of the United States and the American people. There is no interest in Ukraine, and we certainly have no vital interest there, but we have no interests that are so important that they would be worth risking the existence of this country. So what do we do about Ukraine? We should take Ukraine as an object lesson in what happens when the United States allows the strategic balance to tip against itself. We're going to see a lot more of this, because the Biden administration is weak, and multiple administrations before the Biden administration have allowed us to become inferior in the most important part of the military balance, the nuclear part of the military balance. And that's what happens when you can put an aggressive umbrella over your activities. The defensive nature of the U.S. umbrella, it loses credibility, you know, when the other side has got these advantages. And they will start exploiting it. Russia will exploit it. China will commit acts of aggression. So will North Korea. So will Iran. We're going to see more of this. So we should, you know, use this as a lesson and avenge Ukraine by rebuilding American nuclear, military, and economic strength so that we can prevail peacefully the way Ronald Reagan did during the Cold War. We won the Cold War exactly to that formula, peace through strength, but becoming so powerful that our adversaries, in the end, not only dared not start wars, but the internal contradictions of their dictatorships and tyrannical systems in the arms race against us ended up undermining their own societies, and they collapsed under the burden of the arms race. Ronald Reagan, Lindsey Chicken Hawks like Lindsey Graham forget, Ronald Reagan fought no major war. The only war he fought was the invasion of the little island of Grenada, you know? But he managed to win the Cold War decisively and made the Soviet Union go away peacefully, you know, because he built up our military strength. And that's what the lesson we should take from Ukraine. You know, the best of revenge for Ukraine will be for us to win the new Cold War peacefully.
Right.
Yeah, and get back our energy independence and all of those things.
That's all part of it. Yeah,
that we had in addition to maybe they can wake up and smell the coffee and consider things about the grid, because we are in a much more vulnerable position than a lot of people realize. Anyone who's listened to you on a regular basis or read any of your books totally gets it, but I don't think the average person really gives that much thought.
Yeah, the average person, one interviewer kind of sprung this on me and said, look, what you're advocating, let's put it in human terms. It's as if you're saying that you're seeing a neighbor, you call that neighbor Ukraine, being beat up by a burglar, and you're not going to come to that person's rescue. You know, isn't that shameful? How can the United States do that? Well, let's take that same analogy and make it a little more accurate, okay? And let's say there is a neighbor, and call it Ukraine, that's being beat up by a burglar who's armed with a machine gun,
yeah.
You know, a modern machine gun, okay? And you have a family to protect, and this guy knows where your family lives, and you are armed with a 22 caliber pistol that hasn't been tested, that you inherited from your grandfather, and hasn't been tested in 30 years.
And, yeah.
And
trigger
you know
finger
if you go
arthritis.
To this guy's rescue, that you're going to have a gunfight, and it's almost certain that you're going to lose. And then this guy is going to go and kill your family.
Yeah.
What's the right moral thing to do under that circumstance?
Right. No, you're absolutely right.
I bet they enjoyed that answer.
Yeah.
Fellers, we got to leave her there. We can absolutely do this again, and I think we should, because it's important to counterbalance what's going on out there. There's a lot of stupidity being proffered on this particular topic. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is on the road, on the way to Florida. Have a terrific time. We will see you very soon. And you can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again. Places that I've never been, seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road again.